Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon, and we have a great podcast planned for you today. This year, I really want to focus on making sure people in aesthetics are doing things within the boundaries of the law, because aesthetics is getting so exciting. There's new advances, there's molecular techniques coming, and some of these are not FDA approved for use in different manners that we're using them. So today on the podcast, we're talking to Sarah Schickman. She is a distinguished attorney, a healthcare attorney, and an entrepreneur with over 16 years of experience. She's one of the managing partners at Lingea Law, and she's guided more than 1,000 patients with these complex healthcare issues. And I think we really need to dive in because people are doing crazy stuff out there, Sarah. Welcome to the podcast, and let's talk about how to stay out of jail as an aesthetic injector.
Yeah, I think the number one way to stay out of jail is probably not to do things that cause one to go to jail, right? That seems simple. But I think with a lot of the gray areas in our space, it's kind of hard to figure out, okay, well, what is it that would cause someone to go to jail or lose their license or pay a huge fine? So we're going to talk about all those things.
And we're saying it kind of jokingly, but I will say for sure that there have been legal cases in the media this year where not only were there patient deaths, but also healthcare providers did get licenses lost and go to jail. And so it's really, truly serious territory. But for example, like some of the things that are trending in aesthetics right now are using products that are labeled for topical use, and microneedling, and then I think injectors are innovating the use of those and switching them over to injectable use in their practice. So, can you tell me a little bit about, when the FDA approves a product for injectable use versus when people start using it as cosmeceutical? How do we play in that playground?
Yeah, and that's a great question. When the FDA approves a product for injectable use, it goes through lots of process and lots of study, and it's a very, very big investment from the pharmaceutical company doing it, and it's a very long process with the FDA. And the goal of that process is to ensure patient safety as much as possible. And then there are products that are considered topical that are basically skincare. The word cosmeceuticals is not really like a legal term. So there isn't like, okay, as long as this is a cosmeceutical, you can do this. It's basically things that are approved by the FDA to be injected and then everything else, right? So we have all these new products that to date have not been approved by the FDA for injecting, but people are injecting them. So what happens to those people? What kind of liability do they have, and how do they protect? So the first thing is in the patient consents that you have patients sign, make sure that you disclose the risks of what you're injecting and the fact that it's not FDA approved. So that and make that as clear as possible and work with your attorneys to create those consents, not, ChatGPT or some getting something off the internet. So that's the first thing to protect yourself. The second thing is make sure that you personally feel comfortable injecting this thing that hasn't really been studied for injecting. Try to find things that if you're going to inject them, maybe there was a study about this thing being injected, but not in, let's say, the face. Maybe the study was that being injected into joints or something else. So something would be theoretically safer to inject if it had a study for injection anywhere in the body. But if you're going to inject something that has absolutely no studies of getting injected anywhere, you're taking on a big liability. And you, as a medical provider, can take on that liability, but a consent will not fully protect you from that liability. So we've had situations where, for example, somebody injected some platelet product, and then the patient got some adverse reaction, relatively minor, but on someone's face, nothing is really that minor, right? If someone's face becomes like a little bit red or puffy, the patient was extremely upset. They wanted a refund plus a lot more money than that. So the liability will really be on you if you inject something and there aren't any FDA approved indications for injecting it anywhere.
Yeah, so you need to have kind of evidence-based guidelines to say that it's been used in humans before and that these humans turned out fine and same area of use, roughly.
Yeah, and I think as a physician, someone has a lot more room to do these kind of things than, let's say, someone is a registered nurse doing it, because the licensing boards give you a lot more deference as a physician than, let's say, if you were a registered nurse. Even if you're a registered nurse who did thousands of treatments, that's just how they view it in their way.
Yeah.
So I would say, if you're a physician, you have a lot more room. But at the same time, you also have a lot more to lose because it's your license. And a lot of times, once you have something on your license, it follows you for the rest of your life.
Yeah. It's an interesting scenario because I guess we are using products off label all the time. And as a doctor, you can do that as a, I'm not sure, and you'll have to teach me that for PAs and nurse practitioners and RNs and things like that. But as a physician, you can take an FDA approved product and use it off label, correct?
Definitely.
Yeah. So that
And
means if I'm using a product like Sculptra for the face and I decide to put it in the butt, that's an off label use.
yep, and that's
Cheek
totally
butt
fine.
cheek. Right.
Yeah, no problem. As long as I would say you have it in your consent that you're doing it as an off-label use. And then also, I would recommend checking with your insurance and having it specifically added that you're doing, let's say, Sculptra BBLs, you would put that on your insurance policy to make sure that they cover you up for that.
Interesting. I was at a meeting, the Genesis meeting with you, and you had some really interesting thoughts about polynucleotides. And then you did mention also reaching out to your malpractice carrier to make sure you add, what was that specific to polynucleotides? I'm trying to remember what you were saying.
Yeah, I was saying that, sometimes we may be doing like 50 different treatments in the office, or in your case, your office is very innovative. You guys are probably doing lots of 100 different treatments with,
Yeah.
right? So adding every single treatment to your insurance policy would be very cumbersome. So what people can do is just send an email to your insurance company and say, hey, these are the products that we're using, and these are all the treatments. Look at our website. That's better than nothing. So I would recommend at least doing that, at least putting the onus on the insurance company to then come back and say, wait, 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 you need to do this and that to get this approved. But at least you have a record of an email that you send to them asking for approval or notifying them. But we have seen situations where insurance companies have said, well, we told you we have this line here that this is not FDA approved, so we're not covering this. Or we've even had a situation where an insurance company said, these are our approved consent forms that you have to use, and if you didn't use our consent form, we're not covering you. That was for a laser situation, so I think this may be a little different. But I think, like, people have this misunderstanding that, let's say you're using Sculptra, right? If you're using Sculptra, and even if you're using it 100% on label, it doesn't mean that the manufacturer of Sculptra is going to protect you in case there's some kind of like lawsuit. It's really going to be on you and your offices and your legal procedures. So the legal protection you have from the manufacturer is pretty small, even if you're doing something on label.
So we've got to redo all our consent forms, make sure we're adding instances where we may use the product in an off-label manner, and then we really have to inform our malpractice companies because that's a big thing. Every year there's like five new products launching now. With molecular science, we have, growth factors, we have polynucleotides, we have exosomes, and the science is all super new. So I'm very sure that they're not used to these ideas as a conventional treatment yet.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I think those two action steps are really good. Updating your consents, calling your insurance company, and number three, updating your in-office procedures. So I think sometimes people may feel like they can do whatever they want. Like after the person, somebody in the office goes home and there's one provider left, and that provider says, well, Okay, in our office, no one ever told me that not to do, this particular procedure. Let me try it on my friend, or let me try it on myself. And then things go wrong, and all of a sudden, that friend is not your friend. And so it's really important to have written procedures in your office that say what every type of person is allowed to do, meaning your PAs are allowed to do this, your NPs are allowed to do this, like down to the body part. So if someone feels bored and their best friend comes, they don't just in start injecting, filler into someone's butt, which actually happened at a practice. Like, someone had a dimple in their butt. They decided that it was a good idea to inject Voluma into that dimple. Unfortunately, there was an infection. And so that even though that person was a friend, it didn't go so well.
That's terrible. What are kind of the most common claims that you're seeing that arise out of med spas where, you're seeing problems where legal cases develop?
Interestingly, the biggest area is lasers. Because with a lot of things like biostimulators, neuromodulators, fillers, over time they could either be reversed or they go away on their own. But with lasers, once someone is burned, it's really hard to get rid of the burn. You can try creams and surgery and whatever. But so I would say over 70% of what I see with claims have to do with lasers, actually. And a lot of times with hair removal and a lot of times on darker skin.
Wow. And is it kind of like these places that are laser mills that do a whole lot of hair removal and then they're just taking untrained staffing?
Yeah, a lot of the places that it's happening to are places that don't even have a medical director, where there's just someone on who lacks training operating the laser. They're not familiar with exactly the settings to use, but even sometimes using all the right settings, sometimes things go wrong and the person doesn't know when to stop. The patient said, oh, like, this hurts, and the person continues. And then, so I think that having a lot of training really helps reduce some of these issues that happen, and having properly licensed medical providers involved. But yes, a lot of we have the most the biggest majority of cases we've seen have to do with lasers, and the vast majority of them have to do with places where there wasn't the proper medical provider, even on staff. Not even forget about on site, it's not even on staff.
And I think the consumer has to be so careful now to at least try to understand and vet that because they're walking into an office where they assume that everyone's credentialed and that legalities are being followed. But it's very state specific, but most states and RNs require supervision by an MD, right? Nurse
Yeah, in all states.
practitioners, certain states, nurse practitioners and PAs can practice independently.
Yeah, and in most states, laser is considered the practice of medicine. So in most states, an esthetician can't just run a laser without anybody else. So yeah, it's hard. I think for consumers, right? Sometimes people they see someone and they have great marketing and they have great before and afters, and they are tempted by sometimes a really great price. And I get that. I've definitely witnessed that myself. But I think it's complicated because sometimes the great price comes with much greater risk. Another thing we've noticed is that with IV hydration, a lot of times, I'm not a doctor. You know much more about this than me, but what I have seen is like patients have some very severe adverse reaction because the wrong thing was mixed together with something else. And it's going into someone's IV, so it seems like it's much stronger than if they were taking it as a pill. And we've seen a lot of people losing their license because someone literally had a crazy reaction in their office and died or almost died.
Buyer beware. Like intravenous therapies are should not be messed with. And like it scares me when I see the IV hydration rooms that are popping up all over Vegas and all over LA and different places. Cause like I think that very often they're staffed by people who are like hourly rate, fill in from an agency type of RNs and NPs, and I'm very hopeful that everyone has great training, but I also see poor techniques, not such sterile techniques, and like I think medication errors are super easy to happen. And this year in Texas, a patient lost their life from a wrong additive to an IV drip. And it's not to scare people. Like IVs are given, hundreds of thousands of IVs are given, daily and monthly in the US, but and very safely and effectively. But you really have to do your homework and feel super comfortable with the person. And it's always nice to know that there's a doctor in the background. So I think that's really critical. I can't emphasize that enough. I think in Vegas there was also a situation where PRP was blood was spun in a centrifuge, and patients contracted HIV to due to the really crazy awful reusing of test tubes that was done there.
Yeah,
Anything on that?
imagine. I mean, what you saved $100 or something on your PRP, but you got it, a terminal illness as a result of it. I mean, or a super serious illness. I mean, I think it's really a scary world out there. And so sometimes with a lot of these treatments, one small mistake can make a big difference. For example, we've had instances of lidocaine toxicity with a lot of these treatments. A little bit of lidocaine is mixed in to make the treatment more comfortable, like with Sculptra or treatments like that. A small difference could mean the difference between safe and toxic, like someone may have a heart attack. So
Yeah.
really, really important, right? To check as a consumer that the person you're going to understands that has the right credentials. And we, with that particular situation, we've seen people lose their license because
Yeah,
it
cardiac
was a
arrest is a big deal when you're having your Sculptra. I'm sorry, that's like, but I would tell the consumer out there that very sadly, I would say the vast majority of injectors are not aware of that. And we teach this in our my modern aesthetic theory course, and I'm super, as a surgeon, we calculate your lidocaine dose when you arrive based on your body weight, and we make very 100% sure that we underdose the amount of lidocaine added to all the vials, because it can stack up. You're getting 20, 30 vials done in your butt or other places. Like you become very close to like the lethal dose or maximum dose if you're not careful and you don't modulate that. And like I don't think the consumer knows that the average nurse or nurse practitioner or PA or I mean average is average. There's always excellence. You should strive for that. And maybe you even ask those questions. But it's so awful that the consumer has to be put in that position. You would expect that professionalism everywhere you go, and yet it's not there. Many people learn how to do their injectables off of YouTube or watching Instagram. Sadly, this is the reality of the world we live in. Like, they don't read books, they don't take classes, they don't get certifications, they maybe don't have degrees, and they're out there practicing. So like that's the buyer beware message that you really have to vet this person. Are they board certified? Are they super credentialed? Do they take a lot of classes, you know?
And I've had situations where on the website it says the person is board certified, and they're actually not. They just actually like the person actually wrote that they are, and they're not.
Yeah.
That it's really a weird world out there that that happened.
Yeah.
But enforcement is up in many states. Like for example, in New York, there's a new task force that's created by the different boards where they have. A lot more resources, and they're literally going door to door to different med spas, starting with actually more in upstate New York because Albany is where like the headquarters of the boards are in New York. And so I guess it's a shorter trip for these investigators, but they're literally going to multiple people a day and saying like, do you have this, procedures? Who is your medical director? Show us all your paperwork. So just be ready because a lot of times I think in some places, like people have been in business for 20 years, they never saw anyone, and now it's really become the focus because of patient death and because of all the new treatments that have come out.
Well, what do you see as like upcoming regulatory changes that can make it either easier or harder for practitioners to use the new biologics like exosomes or even peptides in their practices?
I think the FDA will likely come out with new position statements on these products this year, especially if adverse events are experienced. So if there's going to be a patient death or multiple, I think the FDA will come and say, okay, well, we are aware of people injecting, let's say, exosomes, and you shouldn't do that. And if the FDA does that, then right away you're basically on notice that if there was a complication, the malpractice attorney would say, well, if the FDA said this is not safe, then you weren't following reasonable standard of care. So it's just important to stay abreast of those kind of things. I think with the new administration, the FDA will be a little bit more open toward new therapies. And I think that in general, as long as we continue this trend where the new therapies are proven to work through experience, through where people are doing these treatments and clients are happy, but also there aren't very few adverse events, that'll be great. And the FDA is not going to issue any position statement saying these treatments are not safe. However, that's always subject to change. And it's a little unfortunate where if there are a few practitioners that are doing things badly and there are adverse events, the FDA is likely to come out and say, hey, these treatments are not safe. You shouldn't be injecting them. You shouldn't be using them until there are FDA trials on them. But in general, I think the FDA's position to be a little bit more friendly toward emerging treatments than they were in the previous administration.
So currently, the legalities surrounding exosomes are that they should only be used for topical microneedling treatments, right? Have you heard anything other than
Yes.
that? So we do see people injecting them into the hair, injecting them in places in the body. I've even seen IV exosomes given to some of my patients, which, unless they're your very own exosomes, I definitely would not do that. So I think that they have had emergency FDA approvals for people who are like on death's door with COVID and having pulmonary shutdown, and giving exosomes truly helped those people to recover from their whole acute respiratory distress in a white out lung. But other than that, it's really not approved for anything,
Yeah,
right?
I would say exosomes are really not approved for any kind of injecting anywhere in the body, and doing it is dangerous. So, if I was a practitioner, I would say it doesn't really make sense to inject exosomes right now because it's the liability, the potential liability is too high. Because it's going to be pretty easy for a lawyer to show that you didn't meet the standard of a reasonable person, where you injected something that was not studied for injection in the body or FDA approved for injection anywhere in the body. There are plenty of other things you can inject that are FDA approved for some, for at least something. So I would go for those things first. Also, speaking to some of these companies, they say that their products are not made to be injected, that they're not formulated for injection, or even when they're microneedled, they get destroyed. So with some of these exosomes, like, does it even make sense to inject them? Is it worth the liability? I don't think so.
Yeah, I agree. Can you talk a little bit about polynucleotides or the salmon sperm craze, where people are also microneedling that, but they have been used in Asia and other places as injectable treatments, like under eyes and around. So they're also sold in a syringe form, even though they're for topical microneedling. So I feel like it's so much mixed messaging for the aesthetic injector.
Yeah, in the US, the FDA does not care if a product was approved overseas for anything. Neither does the US law. So I think that even if salmon sperm or some of these other things were approved overseas for injection, that doesn't mean that they're safe to use, or you could use that as your reason should something go wrong. So personally, I don't think that it makes sense to do those products, injecting those products today in the US. You're just taking on too much liability for yourself. Some people may say to themselves, okay, well, I'm going to treat, 1,000 people with this for $1,000 each. And if I get in trouble, okay, that's going to cost me $50,000. And then, I'm just going to fight it. But it's a pretty short-sighted perspective because once you have a warning on your license. The next time it's not just a warning, they're going to suspend your license or do something else. So even if you're making a financial decision, it's not good when it comes to safety to make decisions that way, because long term, it's going to lead to some bad consequence both for yourself and for your patient.
I think if you have to try these treatments and you want to, have a logical approach, then you have to come up with a clinical trial and you have to go through the motions and, talk to the FDA. Is it an investigational use of a new drug designation? And you have to have an IRB, like a research board, decide that you're doing ethical and safe study, and then you go for it. But nobody does
Yeah,
that.
I mean, I think it's very expensive, right? So a lot of people find it cost prohibitive, but companies are getting investors and are trying to do some of these studies, and they will happen, but they just haven't happened yet for things like Salmon Sperm or exosome. But I think they are pending. I think the companies are trying, but it's going to take time. But there are lots of treatments available today that are FDA approved, but
Yeah.
also off-label, there are lots of treatments there, and I think that then it becomes, as a provider, you protect yourself with paperwork between
Yeah.
you and your staff, between you and the clients, and you and your insurance.
Now, how about mixing products into, let's say we're using a filler and we want to add nutrients that are normally given in the body, like vitamin B12, or we wanted to, products that are just amino acids or normal minerals, vitamins, can those be mixed in with your injectable, or does that change the whole
Well,
the approval of that product?
yeah, great question. So again, that becomes off, completely off label, and then you would look at each product separately. Okay, has this formulation of vitamin D been approved for injecting, and has this formulation of filler been approved for injecting? Okay, if yes, then you can proceed with the treatment, but it's off label. But if what you're injecting some, vitamin D that is not approved, or it's not supposed to be injected, but you decided you have a vial and you're going to inject it anyway, that's not a good idea. But also realize, like, just because something is a vitamin doesn't mean that it's safe. So, like, there are lots of vitamins where if you inject that whole vial of the vitamin into someone's body, like, they may have a huge reaction that you're not prepared for. So it's really, there's a reason why there aren't FDA studies of all these combinations of things. They're very expensive and they're very particular, so it would take a long time to get all these things approved. You don't want to be the one doing the experiment on your patients.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the combination can trigger different effects than the solo products by themselves. In terms of platelet-rich plasma and PRP, people really are using that liberally and feeling like that because it's your own product harvested from you as a human, you don't need any special approvals and you can do anything with it anywhere. Is that accurate?
Again, it's one of those things where
It's not a drug, it's a human-derived product.
yeah, I think that it's not a drug because it hasn't been approved as a drug to treat any of these things, but what you're doing with it is not specifically approved, so you're really on your own should something go wrong. The chance of something going wrong, at least based on what we've seen through our data and through the malpractice suit that we've seen, is relatively small compared to some of the things that where it's not made out of your own stuff. But again, you just never know. Sometimes, again, it's mixed with lidocaine, it's mixed with some other things. So just make sure that whatever you're doing, you feel really confident that you A, have adequate training, and B, that legally someone, not a Facebook group and not the internet, told you that it's okay to do.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And in terms of other products like growth factors, there's platelet-derived growth factor, one of my favorite products area, since that's FDA approved for use in orthopedics and in surgery and oral maxillofacial surgery injected into joints. What's the legalities of taking something that has all those FDA approvals and injecting it elsewhere in the face?
Yeah, so that would be an off-label injection, which is much more safe than just injecting something that's not FDA approved for any injection anywhere. So that's kind of similar to Sculptra being FDA approved for here, and you're injecting it here or wherever people are injecting. So it's, I think it's relatively safer to do that, but just be very clear in your consents with your patients that this product is not FDA approved. For this particular use and the special risks for that. So that shouldn't be like a line buried in at the bottom somewhere where no, someone say they didn't see it. There should be a paragraph explaining that it's not FDA approved. And then there should be a paragraph explaining like what are the possible side effects to make it very clear that this product is not just risk-free and also the lack of FDA approval for injecting in the face.
Got it. Yeah, I think that's so important. So basically, transparency is one of the main things I'm hearing from you, is you have to be so transparent in terms of teaching your patient what they're about to get done.
Yeah.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about peptides and like the new longevity managements that we're doing in the office, which again, peptides are some of them human-derived compounds, like your own body makes BPC-157, the body protective compound. And so I think people need to be aware of the problems with the compounding pharmacies that are creating these products and whether they're research or animal-based products. So can you dive into any scenarios where you've seen problems with these?
Yeah, I think that with compounding pharmacies, there's very little oversight about where the products are coming from and whether they're being sh coming from China, whether they're for research purposes, whether they have additives. Again, these things are not, the compounded versions of these things are not FDA approved. So you have to make sure that in your paperwork you discuss this and the added risks of this. The compounding pharmacies themselves sometimes are saying things that are not 100% legally accurate. So don't just take a compounding pharmacy's word for it. Ask your lawyer about it. And for in terms of your clients, it's really important to educate them on like no results of these things are really guaranteed. And these are the you expect a series of treatments and some possible side effects and all that stuff. So with, like with anything else, it's about client education and being very transparent with your clients, but also in this case, with your vendors, really not taking their word for what they say, especially when it comes to some of the things like you may ask them. In some states, the pharmacy that you're getting it from has to be registered with the state and has to have a special permit from your state. They may not have that permit. They may just ship from out of state. But they're not allowed to do that. So always ask your pharmacy, like, do you have the required permit to operate in our state?
Yeah.
Ask them this in writing and
Okay.
make sure you get an answer.
Can you be a distributor in California, for example? Like you
Exactly.
can compound here, but can you distribute here? Or you can ship it in from your Texas facility, but are you authorized to distribute in California? That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then are there other legal designations that they need to have in order to be a good compounding pharmacy?
It depends on the state. So the regulation of compounding pharmacies, a lot of it is really state specific. The FDA doesn't have a lot of regulations around them. They may say, oh, the FDA came to, you know, came to visit us or inspect us, and you would ask them, oh, you know, what exactly does that mean? Do you have any paperwork from the FDA saying your facility was approved? So it's a changing industry too. I think there'll be more regulation coming to compounding pharmacies. Right now, a lot of it is a bit in the gray area.
And what is the 501 designation? Like the am I maybe I'm even saying it wrong? Was it 503 or 501?
There are two types of pharmacies. I think it's 503A and 503B.
Yes. Okay. I'm
And
thinking taxes when I'm thinking 501. Sorry.
yeah, maybe you're thinking of 501c3, like
Yes. Yes.
nonprofits, maybe. So yeah, so there are two different types of pharmacies. One is allowed to do more than the other, and one is subject to more regulation than the other. But right now, a lot of them are one, they're not really operating within those two fields correctly. So ask your pharmacy for their supporting paperwork. Like, are they an A pharmacy or a B pharmacy? And then, what paperwork they can show you that meets those standards. One is allowed to do more bulk shipments and like in-office use. One is allowed to do only patient-specific orders. And there are some other differences between them, but
Yeah. So I think 503A is patient specific. Like I give you a prescription and the pharmacy can fill it for that particular compounded patient need. And then 503B is that more like they can produce bulk amounts of product and they compound and then distribute it. And they have to be regulated by the FDA and they have these good manufacturing practice guidelines that they have to follow. That's kind of my understanding. So 503B is like they're a big producer.
Yeah, and I think, but just because one of them is the B type doesn't mean that they're actually up to date on all of that stuff, because the FDA has, there have been a lot more compounding pharmacies now more than ever. So a lot of times their certifications may not be up to date in terms of what they're supposed to do. So don't just because they are saying that's what they are, you can ask them for their supporting paperwork and see if they actually have it.
Got it. And in terms of giving a patient peptides or these bioactive compounds, are there any guidelines that you suggest that longevity clinics will follow?
Paperwork, in terms of having really good consents that talk about the risks, benefits, and possible alternatives to these things, talking about that they're not FDA approved, and then not promising any kind of results. So not talking about it treating any kind of conditions. So not saying this is gonna, I don't know, cure your X or Y disease, but just saying, maybe it's gonna make you feel generally better, or make your skin appear healthier, and not promoting any brand names of anything if you're not actually selling the brand name. So a lot of these fights that we've seen between big companies and med spas, for example. Someone's saying, okay, they're selling Ozempic, but in really they're selling semaglutide. So these companies are searching the internet for people saying Ozempic, but not actually selling Ozempic, and then filing actual lawsuits against people. And these lawsuits are getting settled for hundreds of thousands of dollars. So
That's
imagine
their trademark and copyright infringement protections, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which they should go after people if they're saying they use Ozempic and they don't.
For sure. I mean, they've invested billions of
Catfishing.
dollars to create these things. And if someone is saying that they're doing Ozempic and they're actually selling semaglutide, like, they're also not telling the truth.
Yeah. No, the FDA has FDA approved 26 different peptides as drugs. So would you say if you're giving peptides, you should stick within that realm as like a good starting before you advance into the really complex and different peptides that are not FDA approved?
Yeah, definitely. I think whenever you're going into something that's not FDA approved for anything in terms of injectable, you're going into a territory of a lot of legal risk. So first, you should stick to the things that are FDA approved. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, I think this is so fascinating. I have a bazillion other questions I want to ask, but before getting too esoteric, where can people find you if they want to reach out and ask all of their legal questions and guidelines?
Our website is lengialaw.com, which is lengialaw.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. We do offer free consultations, and we love hearing from people. And no question is too small or too large for us. We've heard it all. We've seen it all. Sometimes we get these interesting questions where, let's say, someone wants to buy this new product, but we just heard of a lawsuit with our other client that has to do with this new product. So we can kind of tell you, like, hey, this is something to watch out with, just because it's a pretty tight-knit industry, and everyone I think we all know a little bit about each other, and so it's helpful to just kind of have a sounding board.
Awesome. I think that's so valuable. I feel like we need to do another podcast because I have a whole nother section of questions I want to ask you about before and after pictures and going after people who write terrible fake Yelp reviews and like
Oh yeah,
all
we should talk
kinds of
about that next time. Yeah,
we
that's a big one.
should. Okay, so part two is coming soon. Until then, don't forget to reach out and find Sarah Schickman on her various handles. What's your Instagram too? Tell everybody.
It's Sarah Schickman. So it's my name is very complicated. I'm sorry. It's from Ukraine. So it's Sarah, Sara, my last name, which is Schickman. And then my law firm's Instagram is at lingialaw.com. Also complicated. I mean, I think we should have a rebrand. I feel like Beauty by Dr. K is a much better name. So maybe you can find
Well, that's because you didn't have DeRay Raj as the last name. My
that.
last name is super. That's why I'm Beauty by Dr. K or Dr. K. But that's it for now, guys. Don't forget to find us on Tuesdays for longer, more detailed podcasts, and we'll do another one with Sarah Schickman soon. And every Friday, a 5-Minute Friday, you can find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, DrKay, doing amazing things with people's faces. And our website is the same, beautybydrk.com. If you're in LA, come and visit it. We have the most advanced stuff going on for collagen biostimulators, using these products legally and ethically with exosomes, polynucleotides, platelet-derived growth factor, and all the peptides. So, trying to learn and make sure we keep our patients super safe in this process of navigating molecular level beauty. That's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful.